It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Hi, I'm Andy Levy, former Fox News and CNN HLN guy and current cable news conscientious objector. I'm a former libertarian who now sits pretty comfortably on the left.
Hi, I'm Danielle Moody, former educator and recovering lobbyist. But today, I'm an unapologetic woke commentator on America's threats to democracy.
And I'm producer Jesse Cannon, and I'm here to make sure things don't go too far off the rails.
We're here to have fun, smart conversations with some of the most knowledgeable and entertaining people in politics, media, and beyond.
Our goal is to try and make sense of our current crazy world, our new abnormal, and hopefully even make you laugh through the tears.
What an excellent show we have today. Freedom of Mind Resource Center's Stephen Hassan, who's the author of the book The Cult of Trump, will stop by to talk to us about what he's seeing change in the cult of Trump. Then we'll talk to Amanda Moore, who wrote an incredible article in The Nation this week about her time infiltrating the MAGA movement and how she's seen the people she met change and evolve into places of power. But first, let's have some fun.
So, Andy.
Yes, Danielle.
Since Fox News was your former home, I can't imagine that it's as comfortable and loving and embracing as our current home together. But since it was the former place that you used to rest your head, I want to give you first dibs on how you think Fox did on their first circus. I mean, debate, Republican debate. Very serious debate that happened this week.
Let me answer that question with a tweet. And it's a tweet I sent, I think, about 3 minutes into the coverage where I said, oh, God, I can't watch this shit because they were playing that song for some reason. The Richmond, north of Richmond or whatever it is. And look, I have avoided that song, or at least I had until last night, when I was non-consensually subjected to listening
to non-consensual.
A clip of it. Just, oh my God, what? Look, we can get into the candidates and all of that, but Brett Baer and Martha McCallum lost control fairly early. That seems to be the mode for Republican debates ever since Trump came on the scene. It's just nobody cares about the moderators. I thought the crowd was awful. Not even halfway through the debate, I was like, can they do these without crowds?
Oh, that would be amazing.
I understand that you have a crowd there and it gives people energy and whatever. I get all that, but it was so damn obnoxious. And then to ask a UFO question, like, really? Look, I think presidential debates are stupid. I rank them only slightly above the State of the Union speech in actual importance. But this one was, even by presidential debate standards, I thought was particularly stupid.
I mean, so here's my thing. One, I did not get very far into the debate without feeling itchy. You know what I'm saying? Like I needed to shower and I needed to wash out my eyes and my ears.
Mm-hmm. I thought that was code for I need to grab a bottle.
Yeah. To think that any of these people are serious about wanting to run the country, to think that any of those people are serious about wanting to represent 330 million plus people is wild to me. Because there wasn't a fucking person on that stage that was qualified, let alone the lack of journalistic integrity or the lack of journalism that you see on that station and network as a whole. But it was the purpose of these debates are to give voters a window into how politicians think about certain issues, not necessarily how they're going to act when it is a real life scenario, but to give you a differentiating point on how they think about certain issues. What the fuck was differentiating about any of these people? Like you had Nikki Haley that brought up a Margaret Thatcher quote. I'm certain that woman is rolling over in her grave. Like, keep my name out your mouth. To talk about, oh, well, if you want things done, hand it over to a woman. What are you talking about, Nikki Haley? Do you know what party you are in? Also, do you know what complexion you are? I think you forget. They don't care about you being a powerful woman. They literally have taken over bodily autonomy over more than half of the fucking country. And I believe that Donald Trump may have said you don't have the right complexion to be vice president. Wake the fuck up. But I digress. Let me not dig in deep so far. But those are some things that stood out.
Yeah. The only person on that stage who differentiated himself, I think, was Chris Christie, which we expected. This is not even remotely any kind of endorsement for Chris Christie. But Christie and Asa Hutchinson were the only ones who didn't raise their hand when they were asked to raise their hand if they would support Trump if he was the nominee. The worst part of that was watching Ron DeSantis look to his left and right to see what other people had done before he raised his hand.
Seems pretty fucking accurate.
That couldn't have summed him up any better. And he was basically invisible on that stage. And, you know, there is absolutely no way that debate helped him at all. Look, we all had the same thought when we were watching that debate, which is that Vivek Ramaswamy is the most annoying person in the world. And it was very clear that every other candidate on that stage just wanted to shove him into a locker and just be like, shut up, nerd. But I mean, as we record this, I don't know that we've seen, there haven't been any polls yet. I am absolutely positive that Ramaswamy will see a bump in the polls.
I'm thinking that he may have seen a bump before he went on stage.
Well, there is that possibility, too. Although Don Jr. was there, so I don't think anyone else had even a chance to get their hands on stuff.
You know, what got me about Vivek is, one, you could tell by the way that the other Republican candidates were going after him, that they actually do see him as a threat. That, let's just be clear, that if Vivek had not been on stage last night, that the debates would have been an entire snooze fest. Like, there wasn't an interesting person on that stage. And I don't even say that Vivek is interesting. What I will say is that for the minutes that I could stomach the entirety of the debate, is that he did what Donald Trump would do, entertained. He said, let's have fun up here. Because to him, it's all a reality TV show. And where did he learn that from? His mentor, Donald Trump. Just because somebody has hundreds of millions of dollars or $1 billion does not make you smart and capable to run the country. But that's not really what Americans care about. Frankly, they care about wanting to have a drink with somebody or being able to, you know, aspire to a gold toilet too in their bathroom where documents are laid out on the floor. Like, this is the reality of reality TV politics, is that Vivek Ramaswamy fit the shoes the other night of Donald Trump. He took shots. He had his super PAC puppets. He said climate change is a hoax. He went off the rails, wanted to raise the voting age to 25. I mean, he was so right, he was in a fucking circle. You know, like, it was just, like, out of control. But he got the most applause.
No, I agree. He's the only one on that stage that realized that it was a clown show and that what people want is to be entertained. And everyone else on that stage felt like they were living in a pre-2016 world.
Mm-hmm.
Because look, I'll say Mike Pence, he should not be anywhere near the office of the presidency of the United States. He is an unrepentant theocrat who just wants some kind of Christian rule in this country. All that said, he to me was the only one on that stage who I felt like, maybe with the exception of Christie, but who I felt like was his authentic self. Like, I believe that's truly who he is in real life, which is
unfortunate.
Yes.
But, you know, whatever.
But I don't know. It gives him some kind of air. Again, this is just to me, of at least authenticity. And everyone else on that stage, I don't think Nikki Haley believes half the things she's saying. Ron DeSantis, not even worth talking about on this subject. Ramaswamy, clearly, he changes his positions every couple months. And the list goes on. And Doug Burgum, who I thought, I don't know, for some reason, I thought maybe he would be like one of those Republican governors who's kind of moderate and is just kind of I get shit done. Watching that debate, I'm thinking, you know, ABC gum is better than Burgum. Every one of those people on that stage, for the most part, seemed like they were playing a role, except for Mike Pence, who just seemed like, I am a fascist. I'm a Christo-fascist, off stage and on stage. I am the same person. But that is not what people want. People want Ramaswamy.
Right.
The Republican voters in particular, that's what they want. You're absolutely right about that.
They want fucking Sideshow Bob.
Yeah.
That's who the Republican Party is. It's like, who can be the ringleader? Who can be the circus ringleader? That's what they want. And of course, Vivek, we haven't seen the polls, but of course, you are going to see a bump because people are talking about him. We are talking about him because he filled what we thought was going to be the vacuum left by Trump by not appearing at the debate and instead sitting down with Tucker Carlson. I know that we have this in clips, but like, for the love of God, Donald Trump has really lost his fucking mind. Like, that is what I will say about the offering of that counter programming, is that for everything that is said about Joe Biden, not enough attention is paid to the fact that I honestly believe that Donald Trump has lost his shit. And when you look at that stage and you say, so who is the heir apparent? I just want UFOs to come and take me. I want to be taken from this planet. If you had to pick, Andy, one of those people to be the heir apparent, like, and there were no other choices, like, literally, I'm just going to put tinfoil on my fucking head, lay in a field, and wait to be taken.
Gun to my head, if you said to me, one of these guys has to be the Republican nominee and you have to vote for them. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I guess it may be Hutchinson, but I wouldn't be happy about it, but I don't know. But my favorite part of the debate was, and I will freely admit that I did not watch this because this was the post-debate spin room stuff, and I could not have changed the channel faster when this shit show ended. But reading today about how mad Donald Trump Jr., Marjorie Taylor Greene, and a bunch of others were because they were blocked from being in the post-debate spin room. For people who don't know, the spin room is where the candidates and their surrogates go after the debate to talk to the press and explain why they won and everybody lost. It's insane and it's dumb and it's stupid to begin with. So Fox had made it clear that, like, hey, if Trump is not showing up to this, then his people are not coming into the spin room. We're not letting them in the spin room, which honestly seems super fair.
Mm-hmm.
I'm actually surprised that they apparently actually stuck to that, because I assumed that they would buckle. But apparently they didn't, and they did not let Don Jr. in. They didn't let Marjorie Taylor Greene in. She was going to talk about how great Trump was. And they threw the biggest hissy fit. Trump Jr. saying, this is why Trump was 100% right not to go to this debate. First of all, calling your dad Trump is weird.
Yeah, honestly, because I'm like, isn't that your dad?
Yeah, it's just that whole family's just, I don't know, man. You could pay 100 psychiatrists' salaries for 50 years studying that family. But that aside, he said, this is why Trump was 100% right not to go to this debate. No, you have that backwards. He decided not to go to the debate, therefore you are not allowed in the spin room. If he had gone to the debate, you would have walked right into the spin room. It's hilarious to watch them try to, well, spin this. Just the biggest crybabies in the world. It's a classic Trump privilege move. Like, oh, I don't have to show up to the debate, but my team should still be allowed in the spin room. Like,
no,
bitch. That's not how it works.
It's not how it fucking works. It really isn't.
So I got such a kick when I read that today. I just got such a kick out of that. And it's now my favorite debate moment.
I mean, you know, I do want to go to some pieces of what we heard from because you called Mike Pence rightfully a Christo fascist fanatic and he wants a theocracy. Mike Pence very casually said on stage last night that consensus is not what leaders do. And I'm just like, in a democracy, that's actually what we look for, is consensus among our two-party system in order to move the country forward. You said, once again, the quiet part through a bullhorn, that you don't give a fuck about consensus. So that's number one. Number two, you had Vivek Ramaswamy talk about the fact after we're still looking for 1,000 people, 1,000 souls in Maui, devastated by the worst fire that we have ever seen in this country from what? Climate change. drier climates, drier air, just ripe ground for wildfires. Ramaswamy says climate change is a hoax. Tell that to the fucking people that have been living in the southern regions of this country in triple digits the entire summer. Tell that to those of us who witnessed the sky turn a tingy yellow from wildfires in another country that were affecting our air quality in June. You have them talking about abortion bans, and you see Ron DeSantis trying his best to not answer any question and just blame it on the media. Right? Oh, will you support an abortion, a national abortion ban, the way that you have created an abortion ban in Florida? These people, each and every single one of them, are telling you in their own ways that democracy is a thing of the past. Civil rights they don't believe in. They're not trying to build government for and by the people. They alone can fix it. I mean, it was bullhorn whistle after bullhorn whistle after bullhorn whistle. So when folks want to sit back and say, oh, well, at least they're not Trump, they don't need to be Trump to embrace Trumpism. They don't need to be Trump to want to wrap their arms around MAGAdom and take the throne for themselves. They all have the same sick, twisted, anti-patriotic, anti-democratic ideology.
Yeah, and a lot of people are harping on the fact that Ramaswamy took, like, the biggest shots, which is absolutely true, and Nikki Haley got off that good line when she said that he had no experience. She said, and it shows. Mike Pence, you know, called him out and said he was a rookie who needed on-the-job training. Chris Christie compared him to ChatGPT. What we need to understand is that Chris Christie, Mike Pence, and to a lesser but still big extent, are not liked by the Republican base. So you've got people who are disliked attacking a guy. What do they think that that's going to do? All it's going to do is exactly what happens when people attack Trump. It makes them like him more.
Right.
I think that's what we saw Wednesday night. Yes, the Nikki Haley line was great, but I saw people tweeting or whatever being like, oh, she just ended him. She really didn't.
No, she really did not. Again, just so people understand the zombie Trump thinking on that stage last night, when asked, if you become president of the United States, are you pardoning Donald Trump? A, number one, that also signals the fact that you believe that motherfucker's going to jail. Because there's, again, we don't ask for pardons for people who are not convicted criminals. So that's just number one. Big slip by the Fox folks there. And then the show of hands, Andy? The show of fucking hands.
I know. And Ramaswamy led the charge on the pardon thing. And again, that's exactly what the base wants to hear. The base doesn't want to hear Mike Pence's answer, which was much better, where he said, look, you generally pardon someone who has been found guilty and has shown repentance. He said, so, you know, we'll get to that when we get to that. That was at least, again, like a moderately, I don't want to say sane, because again, the only sane answer is hell no, I'm not pardoning him. But if you're going to take that off the table, then at least he gave, all right, a little bit of an answer. But the rest of these guys, and again, Christie and Hutchinson aside, because like them or not, they are the only ones who have the balls to actually say that Donald Trump shouldn't be president. The rest of them, just including Nikki Haley, including Doug Burgum, they all were pretty clear that they think Trump is being treated unfairly and they're going to pardon him. And it was just, oh God, it was so obnoxious to watch. And it was just, Ramaswamy stole the show. He went from being a fringe candidate to the cringe candidate, but that's what they want.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. You know, there's something I've really been needing to get off my chest lately, which is that everyone and their mother should listen to the Andre 3000 album because it lifts my spirits on a regular basis, 1000%. We all carry around different problems, big and small. And let's be honest, when we keep them bottled up, it can start to affect us negatively. That's where therapy comes in. It's like this safe space where you can unload all those burdens and start figuring out how to work through whatever's weighing you down.
Therapy can make a difference. I know this from firsthand experience, and it's not just for those who've experienced major trauma. It's for anyone who wants to improve their mental well-being. Therapy can help you learn coping skills. It can teach you how to set better boundaries, and it can make you be a better version of yourself.
If you're considering therapy, why not give BetterHelp a try? It's entirely online, which means it's convenient, flexible, and fits into your schedule seamlessly. Plus, getting started is as easy as filling out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist. And the best part, you can switch therapists anytime at no additional charge. So why wait? Take that first step towards a happier, healthier you with BetterHelp.
Get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/thenewabnormal today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/thenewabnormal.
Folks, I am very excited to welcome to the new abnormal the leading cult expert, Dr. Stephen Hassan, who wrote in 2019 the book The Cult of Trump. A leading cult expert explains how the president uses mind control. Let me just jump right in and say this. For the last 8 years, I have felt that the way the Republican Party and the former twice impeached president of the United States' control over that party has not been covered in the right way. Then I came across you and your book and watched a couple of clips of you on cable news talking exactly in the way that I have felt mainstream media has ignored what has been happening over the last 8 years. So, Dr. Hassan, give us a 50,000 foot view based on your own experience and your own research into what we have been living through over the last 8+ years under Donald Trump.
Sure. Well, let me start by saying that I grew up in Flushing, Queens, 1.3 miles from Donald Trump. So I grew up exposed to Donald Trump in the tabloids, etc., and watched at least 10 minutes of The Apprentice. But when I was asked by my book agent to do The Cult of Trump, all I knew was he was a malignant narcissist, which is the stereotypical profile of all cult leaders. In fact, in chapter 3 of my book, I compared him with Jim Jones, Sun Myung-moon, whose cult I was in for 2.5 years, recruited at Queens College, which is how I got interested in being a cult expert, was my own recovery. The bottom line is that Donald Trump has been used by authoritarian cults, including Vladimir Putin, who, and I do think of Russia as a authoritarian cult, as I do China. I just did a podcast on China, Chinese netizens who rebelled last year over the COVID lockdown, actually took my BITE model of authoritarian control, translated it to Chinese, and they were all walking around with white paper protesting. So all I knew was Donald Trump had the profile of a cult leader, but then I learned that actually there's been at least 50 years of authoritarians, Christian nationalists, certainly Russia, China, Iran, North Korea, and other enemies, Nazis, have been working to undermine America and America's human rights and regulations over fossil fuel industries, for example. So my thesis is that we need to understand that there's an influence continuum, which is the name of my podcast, of ethical influence. And yes, I think there can be ethical cults where you are loving a particular singer or band or sports team or, you know, a podcaster like yourself, Danielle, who have fans. But the point is authoritarian mind control cults control people's behavior, information, thoughts, and emotions. And now I'll put on my hat as a mental health expert. They create what's called a dissociative disorder. And the best way to explain it is in terms of my own cult experience when I was recruited by women flirting with me at the cafeteria at Queens College in 1974. The old Steve Hassan was replaced by a cult Steve Hassan in the image of Moon, so that I was taught to think like Moon and feel like Moon and walk like Moon and talk like Moon. And my real self was suppressed, not erased, but suppressed. And it was after a near-fatal van crash where I fell asleep at the wheel of a Mooney fundraising van and drove into the back of a tractor-trailer truck in 1976 and was in a hospital away from the cult sleeping. I should say I was sleeping 3 to 4 hours a night, 7 days a week, and constant indoctrination in a bubble. This was way before the internet, but nevertheless, I was in that information bubble. Once I was away from the group sleeping, that opened the door for me to call my sister. Not that I had any conscious doubts, like I was such a fanatic. I was a leader in the cult, but it led to a deprogramming where I learned about Chinese communist brainwashing techniques from the 50s by Robert J. Lifton, who wrote the classic text, Thought Reform and the Psychology of Totalism. And it was with these former Moonies who were asking me questions and getting me to think about my experiences and parallel it with Chinese communist brainwashing that the lights started turning on. And the thing that literally woke me up was they handed me one of Moon's speeches to congressmen and senators. All they said is, what do you think about this? And I knew it had been published by the group. And he was talking about how much he respects Americans and how he's surprised that any American could imagine that he, a Korean, could brainwash Americans. And I had heard him personally at least 100 times diss Americans and talk about the Koreans as the master race. And it was that thought where I realized he's a liar. Then I thought, then I can't trust him. Then he can't be a man of God. And it felt in my mind like a house of cards going plop, 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 because my entire indoctrination was based on the belief he was the Messiah who was going to save the planet. I was like, what happened to me? I was an extra honor student. Right. I threw out all my poetry. What did I do? Who was I?
Let me ask this, because I really like, and I particularly just like the mental image of a house of cards coming in. And this idea that you literally had a crash, a physical crash that would then open your mind to what has been happening over the last 2 years. I think about the House of Cards image that you invoke and this idea of how Donald Trump, over the course of his lifetime, but really over the last 8 years, has built himself up to be the white grievance king. I alone can fix it. I am your savior. I am your retribution. In all of these iterations over the last several years, we've watched his ego and his influence grow. And when cameras go into his rallies and they say to people, but here's these list of facts. Here's these list of lies. You can't penetrate the house of cards that are in their mind. So my question for you is, for you, it was a crash.
Well, the crash led to me being away.
So what would it take, or what does it take, to bring that mental house of cards down for those addicted to Donald Trump and Trumpism.
The key point, and that's why I emphasize it's a dissociative disorder and the person's real self is not erased. You were bringing up in the introduction about how the media has gotten it wrong. The media keeps saying how people are morons and stupid and they'll never wake up. Those types of messages are counterproductive to what we're trying to do, which is get people to start reality testing. So as a Mooney, I was trained to do thought stopping. I was so programmed that Satan was everywhere. I'm from a Jewish family. I didn't believe in Satan or evil spirits. But in the Mooney's cult, I was taken to see the Exorcist movie when it came out. And Moon said, God made this movie, and this is a prophecy of what would happen to you. So what I'm trying to say is that when people are in, especially in Christian-esque brainwashing cults like the New Apostolic Reformation, which I talk about in Chapter 7 of The Cult of Trump, the mainstream media keeps saying they're evangelical Christians. These are cults where the leaders of these mega churches say, I'm a prophet or an apostle. I speak in tongues and I can cast out demons and do faith healing. And through my covering, I can protect you from evil satanic invasion. So when you talk to a cult member who's been programmed that way and you say, but he's a liar and he's a cheater and he's a this and he's a that, all they hear is Satan is trying to tempt me, and they're chanting in their head to stay true to God, to their prophet or their apostle, doesn't work. What does work is a warm, respectful, curious interaction, especially with family members, friends, coworkers that the person had a relationship with before they got recruited and brainwashed into the cult of Trump. And beginning, based on rapport and trust, asking questions. I'm curious. You're against traffickers and pimps, right? Oh, yes, we are. Tell me, what's your understanding of how a pimp or a trafficker grooms people and indoctrinates them and gives them a new identity to become a slave for them, to sell their bodies or to sell their soul to a trafficker? Asking a question, and then you can get into the behavior control, information control, thought control, and emotional control. You can explain phobia programming, and it's different from a legitimate fear where there's actual danger. But the point is that my whole approach isn't persuading people to get out. It's empowering them to think for themselves, appealing to their sense of intelligence, appealing to their sense of conscience and good values. And what's so wonderful right now is there's kind of a renaissance happening because of Trump, I think. There's so many now documentaries about cult mind control situations and podcasts. I'm with my friends saying, let's do an hashtag I got out movement, normalize the fact that intelligent, educated people can be brought into these types of authoritarian mind control cults and engage and start sharing stories, because it will turn the lights on, but it's not going to be by calling names or attacking. Right. It's going to be by, hey, and I'm going to play a role play with you, Danielle. Hey, Danielle, you're an intelligent, educated person. I respect you so much. I'm curious, how did you first come to start believing that Donald Trump is God's agent on earth? You know, think back.
And think back, right.
Because when I ask people, what's your first memory of Donald Trump? They often say he was a dickhead, or I saw him on The Apprentice and I thought he was an asshole.
Right.
No kidding. But they're talking from their real self, not their cult self.
And you're wanting them to go on a kind of mental journey. How did you move from this guy, from you thinking, oh, he's an asshole, to now thinking that he's an agent of God? There is a long path that is in between. I want to ask you this question too. Going back to, again, this dismantling of this house of cards, this smoke and mirrors routine that Donald Trump has, and what we saw. So on January 6, 2021, the world watches with their eyes as thousands of people at the direction of Donald Trump and company stormed the Capitol building, which wasn't even breached in the Civil War, right?
Yep.
Stormed the Capitol building, and we're watching with our eyes every angle. Officers being beat, windows being broken, bear spray, confiscation of materials, all of these things happen. On Earth One, Stephen, we're watching it play out on mainstream news channels and all around the world, and people are horrified. On Earth Two, the Fox News network, we see initial outrage. And then the big cover-up begins January 7th on.
Yep.
So talk to me about that, what many thought, including myself, was the House of Cards crumbling moment. They're going to see with their own eyes versus what has happened over the last 2.5 years.
So the critical thing is understanding we're human beings. We depend on information for our beliefs, for how to navigate. And if we're in a silo, whether it's Fox News or certain thing apps that we're on our cell phone 10 to 12 hours a day, we're going to be programmed to believe that versus mainstream media. And then you add politicians, Republican politicians siding with Trump, right? So the appeal is emotional largely. It's not logical. And basically people are, if they're in an NAR group or they're part of another authoritarian cult, like Jeffrey Charlotte wrote 2 books on the family, did a Netflix 5-part series. Opus Dei is a right-wing Catholic cult that William Barr was associated with, Leonard Leo and the Supreme Court justices. When you understand the mindset, again, the issue is if our goal is to get citizens to use our frontal cortexes and think analytically and look at data and evidence versus reacting emotionally through fear and anger and disgust, it's a different process. So what I'm trying to convey is we have a mental health crisis because we see tens of millions of Americans and people around the world. And social media and AI is being tailored. Remember, Cambridge Analytica hacked Facebook. We now know that there are 5,000 data points in the dark web for every voting American. The bad actors can tailor messages to you based on which buttons to push to nudge you in the direction they want. And what they want is chaos. They want to delegitimize our institutions. They want to delegitimize science. They want to delegitimize experts. They want to distract us from the fact that we have a global climate crisis that is obvious, but nevertheless, all the fossil fuel corporations, and Al Gore did a TED talk recently just naming it, the Putins, the Saudis, and they're doing what the tobacco industry did to say, no, it doesn't cause cancer. Let's hire actors who can wear doctors' clothing and smoke cigarettes on TV. But they knew they were killing people. But for money, they would keep doing it. That's what we're dealing with now, is a global disinformation system. Americans don't have data privacy legislation. We are so open, and then the free speech. Yeah, we have to let free speech. Excuse me? The UK, if you're a terrorist saying, let's go bomb, you know, some white people or some black people, you go to jail in the UK. But no, America, we have free speech. Excuse me? What about the public good?
To your point, and so many points that you have made, and I will tell you, Dr. Hassan, you have to come back again because we don't have nearly enough time to dig into all of the pieces. But to your point, I think that the question is, what about the public good? And how do our own laws and our own supposed values in this country, how are they fueling this rise of authoritarianism, the rise of cult leadership, and giving it the fertile ground that it requires in order to grow? And so we will leave it here today, but I really do hope that you will come back to the New Abnormal and join us again. Appreciate you.
Oh, thank you. So please check out freedomofmind.com and my podcast, The Influence Continuum, and the book Cult of Trump has 100% been validated. So check it out. Thank you, Daniel.
Thank you.
Amanda Moore spent almost a year undercover in the alt-right, beginning in November of 2020 with the Stop the Steal rally in Washington, D.C. This week, she wrote about her experiences for The Nation, and she's here to talk about them with us. Amanda, thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Okay, so I want to start with two fairly basic questions. And the first one is why? What made you decide to insert yourself into this movement?
That's like the hardest question. I'm not going to lie to you. The others are so much easier to answer. I grew up with an evangelical father. So like my dad now, he's still his pastor, raises people from the dead, that kind of thing. So my dad's really conservative. And then my mom is a two-time Obama voter who also voted for Trump twice. I was a libertarian for many, many years because you don't really come out of that environment on the left, shockingly. Before kind of making that transition over. So I've always had this interest in cults, in right-wing extremism, because there were so many parallels to my life. And so, you know, I had that background. I was monitoring things already. And then with the pandemic, my job was in live events. And obviously, we were the first industry to get completely nuked. So didn't really have a lot going on in my day-to-day life. So I wanted to be like a writer or a journalist, but I was not. I was like, well, I'll just go to these rallies and see what happens. And then it just kind of snowballed into all of a sudden I'm hanging out with a Nazi.
Yeah, that's amazing. Considering you thought it was a tough question, that was a really good answer.
I've had to answer this question like maybe 10, 20,000 times. So I've gotten more succinct. But will the listeners find it satisfactory?
I think
so. Who knows?
All right. So the second basic question is how did you do it? Was it as simple as just showing up to meetings, rallies, conferences, etc., and pretending to share their beliefs? And to be clear, I don't mean to minimize what you did by asking if it was that simple, because even if it was that simple, it must have been nerve-wracking as hell. But you know, I'm just curious how you managed to do this.
Yeah, I mean, at the rallies, it was, you know, it was pretty easy. There's a bunch of people all around. And then after January 6th, I bought a ticket to CPAC. And, you know, I used to travel a lot for work. So I had all these hotel points and air miles. And I was like, what's the worst that could happen? You know, like probably other reporters aren't going to go because their outlets won't let them because of COVID, or they're personally worried about COVID or whatever. I didn't mean for it to happen the way it did. I literally just went to some Marjorie Taylor Greene, Laura Loomer, Paul Gosar, like after event. And this guy asked for my phone number. And then 2 weeks later, he's asking me to meet with somebody from the Hungarian embassy to train me to recruit Matt Gaetz to his caucus. Yeah, so when I say it snowballed, I mean, it really did. You know, my approach is kind of just like sit at the bar at events and like wait for men to hit on me. It worked. Was pretty easy in that regard. Yeah,
that's amazing. So you just basically for this period, but 10, 11 months, whatever it was, you managed to convince all these people that you shared their various little hateful ideologies.
Yeah. So it's kind of like doing a dual track thing where another article I wrote about was about fascists. But when I was undercover, I had like an anonymous Twitter account I was using, and I mostly posted about QAnon there because I was also going to QAnon stuff. And that was, I mean, that was like, it'd be $1,000 to get in the door. It's just a huge, huge grift. Yeah. It was a little bit jarring at the times to go back and forth, because when you're in QAnon world, there is no reality anymore. You're completely, you know, removed from the physical world, more or less. Donald Trump is a time traveler, and JFK Jr. is still alive. You know, Nazis right. don't fully bat, at least. There's like a baseline of like, we're on planet Earth.
Right.
But yeah, you know, I would try to match whatever people around me thought and said, and that's, you know, what I went
with. All right, so let's talk specifics. The subhead of your piece reads that you discovered a radical youth movement trying to infiltrate the Republican Party. So let's talk about who you're talking about here. And I guess let's start with Gavin Wax. Tell us about him.
So Gavin Wax is the president of the New York Young Republicans Club. He took over the club a few years ago. And obviously, as you can imagine, New York City Club used to be fairly moderate. I've talked to people within the New York GOP world. And they used to, you know, they say, oh, we used to be able to call on them. They were, you know, nice young kids. And they usually show up to help us knock on doors or whatever. And now they're lunatics. And we want nothing to do with them because he's just really amped up, you know, the MAGA-ness of the organization, which is polarizing in general, but extremely polarizing in New York City. But Wax is well-connected. He, many years ago, back in 2014, started a libertarian blog called Liberty Conservative. On that blog, he platformed James Alsup, who was a speaker at the, you know, the rallies leading up to Charlottesville to unite the right in 2017. He's a neo-Nazi. And Wax was one of the first people to platform his writing. He's platformed Proud Boys and members of Dignity Europa. And so he's got this long background of doing that kind of stuff. But at the same time, his outlet was also scoring interviews. He used to work for Ted Cruz. And so he's known a lot of politicians. And that's coming up now. Now he's got Marjorie Taylor Greene and Matt Gaetz coming to his club's events. So he's kind of a perfect example of somebody who is appears to be well-connected and normal on the surface, but, you know, is at the very least absolutely comfortable platforming a Nazi.
Yeah. Did you learn anything from him while you were undercover that just like was like, whoa, people need to know this?
Well, despite his meltdown on me when this article came out, we were both in Dallas at the Young Republican National Convention when the article was released, and he read it, did not like it. Despite his public meltdown, we never met when I was
okay. That's what I thought.
Yeah, but you know, because the person who introduced us, his name is Shane Trejo, is heavily featured in the piece, and Shane has known Gavin for a really long time, and so Gavin's kind of been on my radar for a really long time. So I do know a lot about him, and I've been writing about him. But yeah, we didn't know each other when I was undercover. He's just mad regardless.
Okay, understood. All right, so let's talk about Shane Trejo, because as you say, he sort of features prominently in your article. What is his deal, and how did you befriend him?
So the event I went to that had Marjorie Taylor Greene, Paul Gosar, and Laura Loomer, of all people, speaking across from CPAC in 2021, was organized by an organization called Republicans for National Renewal. Shane, Gavin, they're both, well, Gavin may or may not be affiliated any longer, I'm not sure, but Shane is their grassroots director. So it was at that event where I met Shane. You know, he told me, I'm going to give a speech. Can I get your number? And I was like, you're giving a speech? You can absolutely have my number. That is how we connected. But like Gavin, Shane has been in this kind of far right world for a very long time. And so he's been pretty well connected for years.
And what did you gather from being with him and seeing him sort of in his unguarded moment?
Something interesting about him is that he was at January 6th. And something that we talked about was how, you know, kind of a bummer to see all these people say it was the feds and Antifa when ostensibly a overthrow of the government is what, you know, he would have wanted, right? So I think, you know, kind of that. But he was the committee chairman for Michigan's 11th congressional district for the GOP, but he recently lost that position to a convicted felon who took his place. Yeah, I don't know if it's a trade up or trade down. It's hard to say. And for years, Shane had published all of this writing that was just like absolutely disgusting, defending the marchers at Unite the Right. He, you know, called a gang rape of a woman in Pakistan cultural enrichment, disgusting, sexist, racist stuff all over the place. And yet he was still able to get elected into his local GOP.
Yeah, frightening. And one last guy, talk to me about the guy who told you that his vision for America was like a friendlier Nazi Germany. Because I don't even know what that means. Does it mean like you make one of the initials in SS stand for smiling?
Yeah, right. Alexander Nelson, who also has gone by Lander Nelson, Alex Nelson, Xander Nelson, A. Nelson. There's a whole slew of names that he's used to kind of swindle young Republican organizations and various GOPs across the country. He worked for the Joe Kent campaign, and they had to fire him because he was so racist. When he was talking to people, people started to wonder if maybe he was like a reporter or something because of how racist he was being. But no, that's just Nelson. That's just who he is. So, and he's been kicked out of multiple Young Republican chapters, Washington State, you know, kicked him out. And then I was, as I said, I was at the Young Republican National Convention this past weekend, and multiple people from various chapters were like, oh, yeah, that asshole. Yeah, I know exactly who you're talking about.
Oh, wow.
Because he's just been changing his name and trying to sneak on in to different places. His goal is to work with politicians. He wants to infiltrate. He was very open about that with me. He wanted me to go to a Young Republican meeting with him so that we could kind of market ourselves as nationalists and have, you know, the backing of, you know, well, you know, we look respectable. We're in a respectable place. It's okay to be a nationalist. You too can be a nationalist.
Right. And a Republican.
No.
I want to point out that, you know, these are not exactly household names, but that seems to me to be the entire point of your piece, right? Like, these guys are working behind the scenes at the local levels, at the state levels of the GOP to try to get in, you know, and become sort of a part of these, what have generally been mainstream apparatus. How successful have they been and how pervasive are they, like, within the Republican Party, within our political system?
Republicans for National Renewal, of which Shane is the grassroots director, of which Gavin Wax used to be, or maybe still is, the national spokesman, and of which Alexander Nelson was the Oregon director. They are invited to fly out to Hungary for the U.S. elections. I mean, you know, Wax is giving speeches to Orban at CPAC in Hungarian media, and the English translation of Hungarian media, Wax was labeled as an organizer of CPAC Hungary. And I don't know to what extent that is true, but I know Hungarian state-sponsored media, right, said in English, it's for a reason, because they want an English-speaking audience to at least believe it or think it. The caucus that I was supposed to recruit Matt Gaetz into was the America First Caucus, which somebody who was not me leaked it to the press in April of 2021. It was widely condemned. Marjorie Taylor Greene and Paul Gosar, who knew about it, pretended they had never heard of it before. R&R was at least connected enough to really think that this was something that they could do. And they actually had support of elected officials. They had these big parties at Turning Point USA. James O'Keefe is there. And Jack Sobiech is there. And Anthony Sabatini and elected officials come to their events. And it seems to be working. It seems like they are having some degree of success because everybody kind of knows who they are. No one's worried that they are toxic or too extreme. They're just accepting.
Yeah, I mean, that's, I think, the most frightening part of everything you've written is just how sort of, for the most part, except for the, you know, maybe like Alexander Nelson, but the rest of them are generally pretty much, they are sort of like becoming the new establishment, it almost feels like. Maybe that's overstating it, but it feels like we're going down that path a little bit.
Yeah, I'll say when I was at the Young Republican conventions past weekend, they had a vote for their national positions and the MAGA caucus lost overwhelmingly so.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah. And of course, some of those votes were political, just like they didn't like the girl who was running, you know, so we're MAGA people. Or, but in some cases, it was also they're not extreme enough for us. So, you know, it kind of it depends. Yeah, that was pretty rare, though. But, you know, a lot of people were upset. Carrie Lake was a speaker at the event. People were upset by that. Ukrainian immigrants, a lot of them vote Republican. And to have your party deny Ukraine's right to exist is difficult. It's difficult to match that. Having Carrie Lake come in and talk about how she won her election and things were stolen from her, just falsehoods. People don't like it. They don't like to look crazy. As much success as these people are having, something has to split in the Republican Party. Something has to change because too many people are too unhappy with the section of the party that's just not living in this world. So I don't know. It's hard to say.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, look, that's at least a tiny bit encouraging, which I'm always up for something like that. Since the article dropped, have you gotten any responses from the guys you wrote about?
Well, Gavin yelled at me twice. He yelled at people who were talking to me at the Young Republican convention. He yelled at them. He said I was Antifa and that this was Young Republicans, not Young Antifa. I was not welcome. But, you know, no, I've written about Shane in the past and Gavin as well, and they won't ever respond to requests for comment, not for me, not from an editor. And so, you know, I don't really expect that. Sometimes they'll do a little press release about me. New York Republicans Club has done a press release calling me a leftist troll. Shane, he still runs his little blog or whatever he does. And he'll write about me, you know, like I'm an Antifa, you know, collaborator or whatever he has to say. So I expect something like that will drop about me. But they are generally afraid to say anything to me, I think. I mean, certainly when I walked into the Waldorf, sat at a table with Nelson after I was doxxed and he knew who I was. I don't think he was expecting that. So They are not operating the same way that I am.
Yeah. To be clear, are you denying that you are a high-level covert operative and possibly a board member of Antifa?
Well, I cannot confirm or deny that, to be honest with you.
Oh, okay. All right. Fair enough.
Some things are sacred.
Now that I think about it, that was a silly question because, of course, you wouldn't be allowed to talk about it. You were at January 6th, right?
I sure was.
Were you there undercover or were you just there more as like just at that point, were you just like a journalist, like wanting to see what was going to happen?
I'd gone to one of the rallies and I like was recording the audio for a podcast that, you know, they were like, oh, I know you're crazy and you're going to go anyway. Can you just, and I will buy the audio.
Oh, okay.
But like, and they had been, but very much, this was in the December rally. They'd been like, you have to wear a mask. And like an hour in, I'm like, bro, I can't wear a mask. Like, I'm going to get my ass beat. Like, this is unsafe, you know? And so truly being undercover was probably the only way to be at those events without a lot of concern. So yeah, I bought a shirt because, you know, January 6th had merch tables. I set the J6 merch tent. I bought a Biden, not my president shirt because I was like, I can't bring myself to wear Trump stuff. But like, this is like, whatever, I can do this. And, you know, I was wearing that. But yeah, I was recording everything. So it was kind of like a little bit of both. I thought I would just go and kind of be there and maybe write about it afterwards. I didn't really plan to interact with anybody directly.
Gotcha. But all these guys that we're talking about, the Trejos, the Nelsons, whatever, what did they have to say about that day? Because I found that interesting.
January 6th was some real 1776 shit. That's what it was. That's what Shane said. And Nelson and I talked about how it was so sad because he really thought these people were going to Ruby Ridge themselves. He thought when the feds come to arrest them that they were all going to stand their ground the way that they had stood their ground on the 6th. And of course, that is not what happened.
To be clear, he wanted them to Ruby Ridge themselves.
Oh, yeah. He said he called his parents that night. It was like, this is what's going to happen. It's going to be great. Yeah. And so that was, I guess, a bummer for him. Of course, he did not go inside the Capitol, as far as I'm aware. When I went to Portland to watch a Proud Boys riot with him, he did tell me, like, these are the foot soldiers, the Proud Boys. They're supposed to sacrifice their bones and bodies for us, the Anglos. And that would have been, you know, how we felt about January 6th as well. Like, these are the people who, this is their role, or they're the useful idiots that go inside and they do it for us. But we're the ones who are actually going to be in charge.
Amazing. Amanda, thanks so much for being here. Everybody, check out her piece at The Nation where she writes about this. And keep an eye on all these names that she's mentioned because, unfortunately, at least in the case of some of them, we haven't heard the last of them. Amanda, thanks again for being here. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Danielle Moody.
Andy Levy.
So, all right, let's close out this lovely debate week. Who is your fuck that guy?
Well, it is a favorite of the show and of mine. And by favorite, I mean I hate her. Marjorie Taylor Greene. And I know, Andy, you're going to think, what did she do this time? You can't imagine. And that's pretty much how I feel. But Marjorie Taylor Greene, according to The Guardian, says that she, quote, knows her name is on, quote, on a list of possible picks as Vice President to Donald Trump should he win the Republican nomination next year. Is she written on the list in crayon? Is it in invisible ink? Is it in ketchup, you think? How does Marjorie Taylor Greene, the tinfoil princess herself, find herself on this list? Here's how. She has waited on tarmacs for Donald Trump and been passed rightfully by after standing on a tarmac for hours. She kisses his ass anywhere that it shows itself, and it shows itself. She ushered in Kevin McCarthy to be the Fisher-Price Speaker of the House by holding up a telephone with Donald Trump on it on the other end on the floor. She is the MAGA handmaiden, doing the bidding of the Grand Wizard, Donald Trump. And so is it shocking to anyone that she may be on the short list? Does anyone believe that Marjorie Taylor Greene should be anywhere near anybody's Oval Office instead of a padded room? No, they absolutely don't. And I think that if Donald Trump, who I believe is just, you know, sunsetting, if he actually believes that putting Marjorie Taylor Greene is going to be what puts him over the edge, he's right. The edge of a fucking cliff. The woman is an anvil. So one can only hope he ties it tight to his ankles.
This is where I sort of get into that be careful what you wish for mode, because part of me is like, oh man, I hope he picks her, because I think, yes, she's popular with the same people he's popular with. So that's a wash.
Right. It gets you nothing.
It gets you nothing, and it probably turns off people who, for some reason, aren't even convinced. You know, I'm talking about like some sort of moderate who isn't convinced that Trump is worse than Joe Biden, but would look at a Marjorie Taylor Greene and be like, okay, this woman is just straight up crazy. So part of me wants that. And then the other part of me is like, again, be careful what you wish for. This was a thing a lot of Democrats tried in 2016 when they were like, oh, please nominate Donald Trump because he'll never win. So, yeah, I think the country's probably better off if she is never a vice presidential nominee. But I don't know. I go back and forth on it. But either way, fuck that guy.
Fuck her. Fuck that guy. Fuck all of them. So as we close out this glorious mugshot week, fucking debate week, just the end of summer, the end of democracy, whatever you want to pick. Andy, who is your fuck that guy to close out this good, good week?
So you touched on it a little bit when we were talking about the debate, but Donald Trump did his little counter programming Wednesday night on Tucker Carlson's Twitter show. Are we calling it a show? Feels weird.
Webcast.
But Tucker Carlson's been doing these little interviews using Twitter to host his video. So that was Trump's counter programming. And I will straight up say I did not watch it because no offense to the Daily Beast, I don't get paid enough to watch that. Nobody in the world gets paid enough to watch Tucker Carlson sit down with Donald Trump. So that aired. I was reading through Nikki Ramirez's piece at Rolling Stone. Tucker's first question for Donald Trump, who's running for president, was, do you think Epstein killed himself? I was like, really? That's your first question? And then as Ramirez reports, Carlson insinuated that Bill Barr, who was Trump's attorney general, had some kind of role in covering up Epstein's assassination. By her account, it went downhill from there. And then today, Trump comes out and says that the interview got over 100 million viewers. I forget his exact quote. He said, looks like the Tucker Carlson interview will end up with an over 100 number. Wow. Let me explain why that's not true. I know you're going to be shocked to hear that that's not true. But it's not true. The video itself has, it does have 150 million views.
Mm-hmm. How many of those are from Don Jr.? Just, okay.
Well, we have to understand that that number refers to anyone who saw a tweet that had that video linked to. So you could just be innocently scrolling through Twitter, although these days there's nothing innocent about scrolling through Twitter, but you could just be minding your own business scrolling through Twitter and a tweet comes through, whether it was Tucker's original tweet or from someone else giving the link. They count that as a view. So obviously, let's not pretend that everyone who saw that tweet watched the video. Let's not pretend that 5% of the people that saw that tweet watched that video. And as Forbes reported, as of Thursday morning, the video itself had 148,000 retweets and a 500,000 likes, which is, if 150 million people watch that, those numbers are pathetic. So let's assume that this number was nowhere near 150 million and probably, I'm going to say, was nowhere near the number of people who watched the actual debate last night. So my fuck that guy goes to Tucker Carlson and it also goes to Donald John Trump. And yeah, I think that pretty much sums it up.
Their equivalent of tens of millions or hundreds of millions of views is Donald Trump telling the rest of us that there were millions of people at his inauguration.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. We all have eyes, Donald.
Fuck those guys.
Fuck them.
Hope you enjoyed checking out this episode of The New Abnormal. We're back every Tuesday, Friday, and Sunday.
If you enjoyed it, please share it with a friend and keep the conversation going. This podcast is a Daily Beast production with production by Jesse Cannon and Seamus Calder.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences, whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.